I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Before we start, I just want to say thanks to all of you who ordered an Unmistakable Creative t-shirt. Be sure to tweet or Instagram a picture with your shirt with the hashtag unmistakable, and we'll give you a shout out in an upcoming episode. And if you haven't picked one up yet, visit unmistakableart.com to buy one today. Now, let's get to the show. In this episode of the podcast, Fortune senior editor Jeff Colvin joins us to discuss what accounts for the difference between people who are mediocre and superachievers and the skills that will be essential to our success in the future. Jeff, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you, Srini.
Yeah. So you and I have connected both via our publisher, who happens to be Penguin. But what really got me interested in your work is two books. The first one being Talent is Overrated, which I devoured because it was filled with so many gems and insights. And then, of course, your new book, Why Humans Are Underrated, which is such an interesting contrast to the previous one. So on that note, can you tell us a bit about yourself, your story, your journey, your background, and how that has led you to this unusual perspective that you have on talent and success?
Well, yeah. I'm at Fortune magazine and have been for a very long time. I have an extremely short resume. I've worked at Fortune. And don't tell anyone, but I've been there since 1978, and wow. So it's just about the only thing I've ever done. Of course, I've done many different things at Fortune during all that time. Mm-hmm. But I've been there for a long time. Having grown up, I was born and raised in South Dakota, Vermilion, South Dakota, which I often think back on as an ideal. In retrospect, am so grateful to have been born and raised there. It was, I just think, the greatest time and place to have been born and raised. So it was a wonderful, wonderful thing. Then, you know, went to college and moved to New York, and pretty soon went to work for Fortune. And so, you know, after all of these years there, I've really had a chance to observe an awful lot of people, business people, leaders of various kinds, organizations, obviously, of various kinds, and had a chance to think a lot about what makes some of them so successful, most of them just mediocre, some of them pretty bad. And, you know, what accounts for this difference? And so thinking about all of that, everything I've been able to observe, plus all the research that I became aware of that was being done on this question, I thought was just extremely interesting. And the real reason I wrote these books about the larger subject is that I do think it's extremely important for people. I mean, I'm trying to do a service here, and I really believe that for people to understand the reality of these topics today is something that's going to be valuable. And so that's what drove me to do these books.
Mm. You know, I really love that you mentioned that you grew up in South Dakota, and I'd like to do a bit of a deeper dive into that earlier part of your story and journey and ask you about sort of moments of significance and formative experiences growing up that would ultimately lead you down this sort of path of journalism.
Well, I'll tell you, I strongly suspect, I mean, this would be at a kind of deep psychological level, but I strongly suspect that it was connected in part to just my knowing about my ancestors. My grandfather had owned a printing business in Vermilion, South Dakota. The business itself wasn't really a journalism business. It published what was called a shopper. It was a newspaper, but it was 100% advertising. Mm-hmm. And it published other stuff as well. But before that, as a young man, he had been a journalist. He had traveled around the country and written for a number of papers around the country. He was a very talented guy. He was also an editorial cartoonist, and he would sometimes, in those, especially in those early days, illustrate his own articles by drawing illustrations, sometimes very funny illustrations. So there was that. And then his father, my great-grandfather, had founded the local newspaper in Vermilion, the paper that still exists and is still published, I'm delighted to say, called The Plain Talk. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so again, by the time I came along, our family had no connection with that paper anymore. But I suspect that all of this had some effect on me. Mm. I certainly had wonderful teachers, a fact that I didn't realize until, of course, I was much older and was able to think back on them and evaluate them. But I had wonderful teachers in school. And so, you know, becoming interested in what I could read and in writing and so forth came pretty easily. I've also been struck, again, as I think back, by what a fabulous culture I was in growing up in that small town, where the expectations, the values were such that education was simply important. No one ever told me, I don't think, that education was important, because no one had to say it out loud. It was part of the air you breathed. And that combined with, as I said, wonderful teachers, that helped a lot too. And so I suspect, you know, you put those things together. I happened to as a little kid, to love reading, and not all little kids do, but I did. You know, you put those things together. In retrospect, you can see the path.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is a question I've asked a lot of people. You mentioned that you could see the path in retrospect. Do you think you could have seen it looking forward?
It's hard to say. I don't particularly think so. You know, look, I mean, when I was a little kid, I wanted to be what every little boy wanted to be back then, you know, which was a fireman and sometimes, you know, out there, I think maybe a cowboy as well or something like that. You know, when I got a little older, and I can't remember whether I was in, what, the seventh or eighth grade or maybe the ninth or tenth, I took one of those tests that are supposed to indicate what you might eventually do. I think it was actually in the seventh or eighth grade. And then you were given the results and said, well, you match up with the characteristics of people who became this or that. And what I remember is the two future occupations that I seemed to match up, with pretty well were explorer and author.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea what to make of that at the time. Mm. I was not particularly fired up to become an explorer or an author at that time, honestly. Sounded good, but, you know, it seemed so far away, I didn't think much about it. Yeah. But again, you know, if I'd been trying to forecast what I became, well, I haven't done a lot of exploring in the literal sense, but I guess you could say that's what a journalist does.
Yeah. When one of the questions I have for you is what you learned about journalistic storytelling from growing up in a small town, and then, you know, what did being in New York teach you about journalistic storytelling about a small town while being in a big city? Like, how did those two perspectives shape the way you tell stories?
Well, that's a really excellent way to think about it. I mean, the experience of the small town growing up was simply one of telling stories and being told stories. This was a time, I mean, we were, the town was sufficiently remote at the time that we got, I think, two channels of television. And those channels were not broadcasting all the time. There was one or maybe two radio stations that we could get reliably. So what I'm saying is we didn't spend a lot of time with electronic media. And we did spend a lot of time talking to one another and telling stories and so forth. So whatever I got from it, you know, I simply absorbed. It was all a natural process. What happened when I got to New York and went into the business of writing and journalism and so forth was that I learned about the demands of written stories, not spoken stories. And I greatly credit the editors who worked with me when I first joined Fortune. The standards were extremely high. They're still extremely high. But the standards were very high. The editors would devote a lot of time and energy to working on the things that I wrote back in those days. And I learned so much from them about how to express things economically, succinctly, interestingly, and always to take the perspective of the reader. How does this sound? Is this doing any good? Is this of interest? Is this grabbing them? Is it boring them? Always to think from that perspective. And they enforced it. And, you know, you combine those things, you know, just sort of the early natural storytelling, plus these stringent standards for written storytelling. You know, I am so glad that it worked out that way because the value of it is more apparent to me all the time. Hmm.
All right. Well, let's do this. I want to start doing a deeper dive into the work that you actually do. I mean, like you said, you've had sort of a front row seat to super achievers that most of us never get. Right. You know, and I love what you said about this idea that, you know, some people are mediocre, some people are wildly successful, and of course, others are terrible. And you spend a good amount of your life studying it as what to, studying what accounts for that difference. So what I'd like to do is spend a good, probably the rest of our conversation, talking about what it is that accounts for that difference and how that's played itself out in your work and your books.
Yeah. You know, for the longest time, I was writing or editing Fortune articles that tended to be about companies or individuals and told their stories. But there was very little that I did that was about the larger principles of what made some people very successful or very valuable. And that really changed when one day I was sitting in my office there and one of our writers came in, and it was Jerry Useem, who was with us for a number of years, a wonderful, wonderful writer. Who also worked on larger projects. He came in and said, you know, we're doing a big special package about great performance, excellent performance, and wonder if you would want to write something about that general topic. And so I immediately said yes, because I had been thinking about it for a long time. And in fact, I remembered at that time having heard years earlier, just heard, I don't think I'd read anything, I'd heard it on the radio or something, heard about a study. I didn't know who did it, didn't know much about it. I just remembered a study about violinists and what made some of them very good. And that probably resonated with me because I had then, you know, I have played the violin since I was a little boy. And so I remembered that study and I thought, well, okay, here's a chance for me, A, to dig up that research, see what other research has been done, and then think about this really interesting topic. So that's what I did. And the result was an article that then became the foundation of The Talent is Overrated book. I wrote an article for Fortune, discovered that the study I remembered, the study about the violinists, was much more important than I realized. It was by a man named Anders Ericsson, a name you will know, who turns out to be the guy who has done the most important research on great performance. And that study about the violinists was, in a way, the foundational piece of research. It was an extremely detailed study about violin students at an academy, a music academy in Berlin, and the tremendously deep research that Anders Ericsson and his colleagues did into the violin students there. And this was the work that resulted in the term deliberate practice, the definition of deliberate practice, and the hypothesis that this was actually what all the world's great performers would have in common. Now, they didn't make that claim in the paper. They said it's a study of violins. But this was the beginning of much more research by him and many others into great performance in people in all kinds of disciplines. And the idea began to come through that there was very little evidence for inborn ability, innate ability to do something fairly specific. And, you know, like when we say someone is a natural tennis player, you know, a born leader, a born pilot, whatever. That the researchers increasingly came to believe that that simply didn't exist, and that this concept of deliberate practice, which has a very specific definition, but this concept of deliberate practice was really the foundation of it all, was really the commonality among the world's great performers. So I wrote this article for Fortune, and I received a response such as I don't think I had ever received for anything I'd ever written before. I heard from lots and lots of people. When I was at conferences and so forth, people who didn't know me would come up and thank me for that article. Some people told me that they had read the article to their children. Now, I can tell you, you can write an awful lot of articles for Fortune and never have anybody come up to you and say, I read this article to my children. But that's what started to happen with this. And so that's when I realized there's more to say and I should probably write a book about it. And so I made that proposal to the folks at the Portfolio imprint at Penguin, and they said, go for it, and I did. And so that's where that came from.
Well, let's do this. I think the thing that people are really going to want to know is how deliberate practices are defined, and more importantly, how they start to implement it into their lives. Because if talent is truly overrated, doesn't that mean great performance technically or theoretically is accessible to every one of us?
Yes. Yes, that's exactly right. And I should stress, first of all, that in the title, Talent is Overrated, I'm talking about talent in a fairly specific sense. Mm-hmm. We all use that word kind of loosely to mean many different things. I mean talent in the sense of an innate gift, something that you bring with you into this world that enables you to be particularly good at some specific skill. Now, it needs to be said also that in skills involving physical attributes, obviously there are things people are born with that are a big help. So just to state the obvious, you know, if you're 5 feet tall, you're never going to be very successful in professional basketball. And if you're 7 feet tall, you're never going to be an Olympic gymnast.
Yeah.
And, you know, this, so sure, you know, people who are, who have particular physical attributes will have an easier time going into some physical activities. Nonetheless, I think the general point is clear. So, yeah, you're right. What it says is, great performance is available to all of us because it appears that deliberate practice is the key. So what is it? What specifically is it? Because one thing I learned was that what I do out on the driving range at the golf course is a pathetic example of deliberate practice, just not even close. So here's what it is. It is an activity that is not performance. You're not really doing it, what you do. It's preparation. So it's not really work, but it's not really fun either. It's hard. It is designed to push you just beyond your current ability to do the thing you're working on. It doesn't try to push you way beyond your current ability because then you're simply lost. And it doesn't allow you to perform within your current ability because then you don't grow. So it is constantly pushing you just beyond your current ability. Now, as you get better, your current level of ability will change, and so your deliberate practice will have to change. And that's another important characteristic. It is designed for you at this moment in your development. And so frequently it helps to have someone else designing it for you because they can observe you. But in any case, it is designed for you and not someone else at this moment of your development. It can be repeated at high volume. This turns out to be very important. The researchers at first just observed that that was the case, that people did repeat it at high volume. Later, brain researchers discovered that repeating an activity over and over really does change. It causes physical changes in the brain. It causes certain neural pathways to become stronger. And if you really get into it, there's a substance in your brain called myelin, and continuous repetition, high repetition of a particular activity builds up the myelin along these neural pathways in your brain and makes them stronger. And so there's a good reason that high volume repetition is important. And then one more thing, which is you're getting continual feedback. You can't get better if you don't know how you're doing. So you have to be getting continual feedback. Now, in some activities, that feedback is sort of natural. There are ways, you know, if you're giving a speech or something like that, you're getting feedback from the audience. You're telling at all times whether they like it or not. There are other things you might do, like swinging a golf club, where you can see whether the shot was good or bad, but you can't observe your swing very well. You're doing it, so you can't see it. In many activities, it's very helpful to have a teacher, a coach, a mentor, someone who can observe you and give you that feedback, and who can also help you design your deliberate practice. That's why the world's greatest golfers still go to teachers, to coaches. They need someone who can observe them from the outside. So that's what deliberate practice is. Mm-hmm. What the great performers do is they do that for a long time. And in fact, your capacity to do that increases the more you do it. It's very demanding.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, the great performers will say it's most demanding on a mental level. You're focused so intensely on getting better that you frequently become mentally exhausted before you're physically exhausted, no matter what it is. Mm. But your capacity to do it increases. And then the great performers will often do this 2, 3, 4 hours a day, day after day, for years on end. And it's not easy. It's very demanding. But of course, if it were easy, it wouldn't distinguish the greatest performers from everybody else. So that's what they do. And it's available to any of us.
Okay, so that raises several questions.
Yes.
Knowing what we know about this, why then do we still have these sort of three tiers of average performance, incredibly successful performance, and absolutely terrible performance?
Right.
Like, why does that still exist, knowing that we being aware of this?
Right. It's a great question, right? It demands to be asked. There are a few reasons for it. First of all, and this is kind of deep, and but it's important. I've discovered, as I've gone around talking about this topic, I've discovered, somewhat to my surprise, that I run into plenty of people who don't like this message. They resist it. They think there's something wrong. They don't like hearing it. And for a while, I wondered why on earth anybody would not like this message. But it began then to dawn on me, and I've asked people about it and talked to people about it. Some people actually don't like the implication here, which is what you identified at the very beginning, that it says our performance, our success at doing something, is in our hands. It's available to all of us, but that means it's up to us. It's in our own hands. If you believe the opposite, if you believe that it depends on a natural gift, and then if you're not very good at something, you can let yourself off the hook very easily. You can say, well, I just don't have the gift. You know, I just didn't come into this world with an ability to do such and such. But if you're told that it isn't a gift, that it's all a matter of what you have chosen, you can't get yourself off the hook. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people actually don't like that. I should mention also that I think a lot of people don't like it because, in a sense, it causes them to lose hope. If they believe in the natural gift explanation, then they can always hope that someday they, or sometimes their children, will find that natural gift that they have. You know, that they've got it there, they just haven't found it yet. But if they find it, then success will be quick and easy. And they hate losing that hope. Well, the reality, of course, is that, yeah, you lose the hope, but you gain the opportunity, you gain the possibility to become extremely good, much better than you are, if you want, which, you know, is, in my opinion, a wonderful thing. But anyway, that's one reason. There are people who actually simply don't like this message. Another reason that so many people are not particularly good performers is that we're not giving anything away for free here. You can do it, but it's hard work. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people just don't want to do it. And that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with them. It's not bad. I mean, especially once you become an adult and you're working and you're supporting a family, perhaps, you've got a lot of obligations. And it's a funny thing. The nature of work in most of our institutions is that we allot no time for practice. Mm-hmm. We expect people who work to go out there and perform, to do the work itself all day, every day. And in most institutions, if you want to really apply these deliberate practice principles, then you're going to have to do it on your own time. And yeah, you may not have much of your own time. And so, you know, you can't blame people for being too exhausted after being done with their real jobs for the day, that they just don't want to do this. Uh-huh. And that's fine. I can well understand it. And you probably noticed the the other factor here, which is, why is it that most companies, most organizations don't include time for deliberate practice? In fact, they don't even really pay any attention to the principles. Well, we could get into that, but the fact is they don't.
Right.
So that's another reason that, you know, we just have an awful lot of mediocre performers and a few really great ones.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because that was going to be the one question I asked from the book itself, which we'll get to in just a second. You know, this raises a lot of questions for me as somebody who has been fired from pretty much every real job I've been at, and now you know, getting to write a book with a publisher.
Right.
Clearly, I don't have an issue with motivation. I don't think I would get to the point of Penguin saying yes if they saw I had no motivation.
I agree.
So what that question brings up in my mind is, is it possible that talent and environment could be mismatched? Like, why would it be that I couldn't figure out, you know, hitting a stride until now at 37, and yet the earlier part of my career would not indicate at all that I was destined for anything? In fact, a boss told me, you don't seem like a person who's interested in controlling your own destiny.
Huh.
So I'm just really curious, you know, based on the perspective that you have,
yeah,
what leads to something like that? And is it possible that talent and environment get mismatched?
It is absolutely possible. And this gets to another question that turns out to be really important, which is sometimes it does take time for people to discover what truly engages them. Some would call it their passion, but to find what it is that truly revs their engine and really gets them engaged. And the reason this is so important is, as I said, deliberate practice is not easy. In fact, frequently, it's not fun. And there's a good reason for that. Remember, you're constantly being pushed just beyond your current abilities. What that means is, by definition, you are constantly going to be making mistakes and having failures because you're trying to do stuff you can't quite do. And so this is not something that people go into because they think it's fun. It's something they do because they are one way or another driven to do it. And some people simply don't find that passion. They don't find that drive. For quite a while. In the book, I tell the story of David Ogilvy, the man who became arguably the greatest or one of the greatest advertising people in the 20th century. He did all kinds of other things before he figured that out. He was an opinion pollster. He worked for the Gallup organization earlier in his career. He had a kind of gentleman's farm in Pennsylvania for a while. He sold stoves door to door in Scotland. He worked in a restaurant kitchen. He did a million things that would lead you to say he's never going to amount to anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got into the advertising business and discovered that it totally absorbed him, totally engaged him. And so until he stumbled into that environment, you know, it's just what you say. There was a mismatch. He hadn't found what he wanted to do. And it's not to say he was great at it from day one. He wasn't. But he was interested in it. And that made the difference.
Okay, so that actually raises questions for me about our education system.
Yes.
And its current form. You know, I my ongoing joke is that I am a failed byproduct of our education system. And I went to a pretty good school. I went to Berkeley as an undergrad. I got an MBA from Pepperdine.
Oh, wow.
And truth be told, my thinking around this never aligned with what you're talking about.
Right.
Until I realized I'd built a house of cards. Right. At the age of 30.
Right.
And I'm just really interested in hearing what you have to say about our current state of education, which I think will actually make a really nice transition to talking about humans are underrated.
Yeah. It's very interesting what has happened in education. which is, well, a number of things, but one of the great things about the education system for a long time was, and to some extent still is, but not so much, was that it did introduce people to a lot of different possibilities, you know, things that they might be interested in. It really opened the world to them and showed them things that they wouldn't have found in their daily life working or in the family or something. And the whole idea was that you were supposed to find, you were supposed to acquire basic skills for simply operating in a modern economy, but you were also supposed to find the things that engaged you. And you wouldn't be good at them right away, but you'd be interested. And what has happened, largely with the rising cost of college education, is that people have stopped regarding college education in that way and have begun to regard it as an investment that must be justified by the return on investment. In other words, it becomes a purely and fairly immediately economic topic. Mm-hmm. So increasingly, we see all these lists of what are the 10 top-paying majors from colleges and the 10 lowest-paying majors and so forth, which colleges are the best buy, you know, will lead you to the highest-paying jobs for the least cost. And in my view, this is a really, really unfortunate development. College, as it should be, isn't this desperate race that I see so many students engaged in now to get the right internship, to get the right credentials, and then land the right job. It's supposed to open you up to a lot of possibilities. And by the way, along the journey there, it also is supposed to just enrich your life by showing you all these things, by introducing you to all these subjects and ways of thinking. It makes your life better and richer every day of your life for as long as you live. And that part of it is given almost no value at all anymore. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes, I think, more and more difficult for people to find what really engages them. And as a result, you know, then they may end up doing stuff that doesn't, and they won't, you know, then become as good and frankly as fulfilled as they could be.
Yeah, I mean, we could probably spend all hour talking about that.
Yeah, I think probably so.
Well, let's do this. I think that that actually makes a perfect setup to talk about careers and the modern world, especially, you know, the relevance and the message of humans are underrated. You know, we just had Zoltan Istvan here, who's a transhumanist candidate for president of the United States, which it was quite entertaining. And he talked a lot about this idea that eventually all jobs are going to be gone. And, you know, we talked about universal basic income and a lot of different really interesting things. And, you know, I think it was fitting and serendipitous that your book just happened to be the next thing I read after that. So I'd love to do a dive into the principles in Humans Are Underrated and talk about, you know, what is it that the future holds for us when so many of our jobs are really being replaced by technology? And what are we going to need to be able to do that apparently robots can't?
Right. Well, this is what everyone's asking, and it's so striking that it's a hot topic, a very hot topic now. I think because technology is beginning to do things that, frankly, are so amazing, that are so close to things we thought technology would never do. They are things we thought technology would never do. And at the same time, so many people, especially in the developed world, are having a hard time economically. Pay isn't increasing very much. More and more people can find only part-time jobs, not full-time when they want full-time. And so you start to wonder. So, okay, how to think about this. The first thing is to look at what the technology can do today and to remember that as mind-blowing as it is right now, the technology is, on average, getting about twice as capable every 2 years. Moore's law won't last forever, but there are other things in technology, other developments in technology, that even after Moore's law will continue to increase the capability of technology at a very impressive rate. So as good as the technology is today, it'll be twice as capable in 2 years, and then twice that in two more years, and so on. The technology is getting twice as capable every 2 years. We humans are not. Okay, we're getting a little better. That's what Talent is Overrated was about. And we can get better. But our rate of improvement slows down with time. Each extra increment is a little smaller than the one before, whereas the technology just keeps doubling. And so it is going to be possible for the technology eventually to do almost anything that we can think of, plus things we haven't even thought of. So that's the first reality that just has to be accepted. I mean, the self-driving car is a great example. It's the one everyone talks about. But it's a great example because you don't have to go back very many years to see very intelligent people writing that driving a car requires so many split-second judgments, involves absorbing so much data from so many sources that it would be very, very difficult for technology ever to be able to drive a car. Well, it now drives cars and does it better than we do. We talk about surgical robots, which are not really robots right now. They are power tools, basically, that surgeons can use themselves. But research is being done to develop autonomous robots that will do things, at the moment, things like identify and cut out cancerous tissue entirely autonomously. And they will go on from there. I mean, I was talking the other day with an entrepreneur in that field who had sold his company. He said, look, in 10 to 20 years, we will have autonomous surgical robots operating on people. Okay, so the first thing is to accept that that kind of thing is just going to go on and get more and more astounding. How then will we humans add value? What I do believe we'll always be able to find some kind of work to do. But is it going to be high-value work? Mm-hmm. Is it going to be something that will enable us to earn a standard of living as good as what we have now and ideally even better year after year? And so that was what I set out trying to find. I said, okay, the technology actually is going to be able to do whatever we ask. So what is it that we humans will demand be done by humans, even if a machine could do it also? And that's then what I try to identify in the book, and that's what then most of the book is about.
So what specifically were sort of the key takeaways that, you know, people can learn from?
The key takeaways are, this is all about human-to-human interaction. The high-value skills, as the economy evolves, are the skills of interacting with other people. And the reason for that is that these are the abilities that we developed as we evolved as human beings. The ability to interact with other people is what enabled us to live in groups as we were becoming human beings. It enabled us to live in groups, and the ability to live in groups is what enabled us to succeed as a species, because the groups are much better at finding and hunting game, at protecting one another. This turned out to be the critically important ability in our evolution. We are fundamentally social beings. Aristotle was right. We are social animals, and that is our deepest nature. So when we interact with one another, things happen between us that we don't even realize are happening. If we are interacting in person, face to face, you know, the pupils in our eyes adjust based on what's going on in the pupils in the other person's eyes. We have no idea that's happening, but it's happening. And we are bonding as a result. We unconsciously mimic one another's postures. All kinds of things happen that we don't even know about that are bonding us as human beings, enabling us to understand one another. And so the abilities of human interaction, being able to deal with, well, I'll get to the specifics in just a second. That's where the high value skills are. And the most foundational one, and this is what people, I think, really need to take away, is empathy. And empathy isn't just feeling someone else's pain. Empathy is the ability to discern what another person is thinking or feeling and to respond in some appropriate way. Some people are very good at it. Some are not very good at it. But this leads to all the other interpersonal skills: collaborating, storytelling, solving problems together, building relationships. Those are going to be the high value skills. And so, as a practical matter, people will want to ask, okay, what about this job I have right now? Does it demand fairly deep human interaction? If it does not, then that job is probably going away. Again, driving is the good example. Driving, I guess it demands some human interaction between you and other drivers, but it's pretty mechanical interaction. It doesn't demand anything deep. That job is going away. There are still plenty of jobs in the economy that don't demand much in the way of deep human interaction. They're going away. And so what we need to be sure is that, A, the work we're doing requires human and rewards human interaction, and then B, we need to realize that however good we are, we can get better, and we'll probably want to do that. That is a really different way of looking at skills and economic success from anything we've ever had before.
Wow. So when these big companies like the Googles of the world, the Facebooks of the world, you know, they're looking at things like this. I mean, when you see it from that perspective, I mean, how does it affect business overall? I mean, we've kind of talked about it from the individual perspective. I mean, what is this going to do for the future of organizations?
Well, a lot. I mean, we're already beginning to see a fairly radical change in the kinds of people that businesses employ. They are able to replace more and more people with machines, and that's not going to stop. These decisions, we talk a lot, people like to opine about the moral implications of this, but these decisions have always been made on economic grounds, and they will continue to be. And so, you know, we have the debate about the morality of a minimum wage and should it be $15 an hour, and we have laws being passed that will require it to be $15 an hour. Well, a business owner simply regards that as reality that must be dealt with. And so what we are seeing and are going to see more is people who used to make less than that are more likely now to be replaced by machines. I mean, in fast food restaurants, the people who take your order at the counter are not doing a job that requires deep human interaction. Mm-hmm. And they're going to be replaced, and in many cases are already being replaced, by kiosks, for example. So we're going to see companies doing that. But at the same time, they are realizing the importance of interpersonal skills in other jobs. And so for the people who do those jobs, we see companies actually working on improving people's interpersonal skills and making sure that those people have an opportunity to use their interpersonal skills. It is, you know, and this has, you know, people say, well, what about the technical skills? What about engineering? You know, all the 8 of the top 10 paying college majors are engineering jobs. Aren't they still going to be valuable? Well, there's a very important distinction to make. An engineer who is technically adept but can only sit in the cubicle and write code or whatever it is not going to be a high-value engineer. The world is producing more and more of those, especially in high-quality universities around the world. The world is starting to produce lots of engineers who can do engineering. The work is being commoditized. The high-value engineers, and I have been told this by employers, the high-value engineers are those who can empathize. That is, they can understand the customer's experience with whatever he or she is engineering, so they can create a better customer experience. The engineer who can collaborate with other team members to solve problems, to come up with new creative solutions that no individual is going to come up with. The engineers who can do those things are the high-value engineers of the future. So just having the degree is not going to do the job for you.
Wow. What are your thoughts on this whole idea of a universal basic income? Because almost all jobs are going away. I mean, is the future of work going to look drastically different than it does right now?
It might. And my own view on it is that it's too far in the future for us to talk about with any confidence at all. Uh-huh. It's important, it's humbling and important to remember that we can never foresee the jobs that the economy will create down the road. You know, even when the internet became available to us and people for the first time were sitting in front of their computers able to get online, we still at that point did not foresee that there would be jobs for search engine optimizers and mobile app writers and social media managers and so forth. No one could have foreseen that. And so, you know, I remain very cautious about predicting what's going to happen in the world of work. We really don't know. But the idea that the scenario you're talking about could happen is at least becoming something that mainstream people will talk about, and that is really, really new. So the idea that technology, advancing technology, overall increases employment and raises living standards has been correct for the past 250 years, and it is absolutely orthodox economics. What's striking now is that we see mainstream economists and technologists, without regard to politics, there are people on the left and people on the right all making the same observation, that maybe that orthodoxy doesn't hold anymore. That just maybe technology has begun to eliminate jobs faster than it is creating new ones. And all I can say is, yes, that might be so. And that by itself is a fundamental change. And it's also important to realize something I haven't seen said elsewhere, which is we don't have to wait for technology to eliminate 90% of jobs for this to be profoundly changing. All we need is for the balance to tip a little bit. Up till now, technology has created more jobs than it has eliminated. It does both, but the balance has tipped in favor of creating jobs. All that needs to happen is for the balance to tip a little bit the other way, start eliminating jobs faster than it creates new ones, and we are in a fundamentally new world, one that we have no idea, that we have no experience with. We have no idea how to deal with it. And that could be happening. There is evidence that could be happening.
Sounds like another book for you to write.
It's the next one, because I deliberately didn't look too far into the future with this one. We've got more than enough to worry about between now and whenever that might happen.
Yeah.
But that is the next step down the road that we have to think about.
Wow. Well, Jeff, this has been really, really interesting and just fascinating and thought-provoking. So I want to finish with my last question, which is how we finish all our interviews at The Unmistakable Creative. Yes. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I think it is themselves. In other words, I think if a person wants to be unmistakable, I humbly offer advice because it's just my view, but my advice would be relentlessly yourself. It's not always that easy in the modern world, but to be just relentlessly yourself. It's the best way I know for anybody, and maybe the only way, for anybody to be unmistakable.
Well, like I said, this has been just fascinating and riveting, and I really appreciate you taking the time to join us and share your insights and your story. And for everybody listening, I'll link up Jeff's books in the show notes. I can't recommend them highly enough.
You're very kind, Srini. Thank you. Thank you for asking wonderful questions and for inviting me to talk about this. You can tell I feel fairly passionate about it, and I really appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, and for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. If you like what you heard, the greatest compliment you could give us is to share the show with a friend and let people know what you think by leaving a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening to The Unmistakable Creative.